Hello, everyone, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis, and this is our 43rd webinar. Woohoo! Before I introduce our presenter tonight and our topic, I did want to let you know that if you're listening in via the Internet, if you want to view the slides, you go to the blue box and click Slides. And you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio, depending on how you're listening, by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. And if you're listening by phone, be sure to mute your computer so you don't get feedback. Tonight's webinar is entitled, let me go to the right page here, Financial Planning for Children with Autism. It's presented tonight by Paul Nidich, who is an attorney at law. Paul, let me get down to your bio, Paul, and I will tell people a little bit about you. Paul has been an attorney in Cincinnati, Ohio, since 1974. He received his law degree from the University of Cincinnati College of Law and his Master of Laws in Taxation from Capital University Law School. Since 2002, Paul's law practice has focused primarily in three areas of the law: taxation, estate planning and probate, and elder law. In the area of taxation, Paul prepares tax returns, he tries cases before the United States Tax Court, and he represents taxpayers in tax controversy matters such as liens, levies, offers and compromise, sales tax, and employment tax issues. In the area of estate planning and probate, Paul drafts simple and complex wills, living trusts, special needs trusts, irrevocable grantor trusts, and other wealth preservation documents. Paul also handles probate matters from simple estate administration to probate litigation. In the area of elder law, Paul advises seniors about Medicaid trusts, wealth transfer devices, and end-of-life matters. Paul is married, and he is the father of two children, one of whom, Alex, is 27 years old and has autism, cerebral palsy, and significant developmental delays. His daughter, Rachel, is married and has two children. Welcome tonight, Paul.
Thank you, Nancy. Hello, everybody. My name is Paul Nidich, and I'm going to talk with you about financial planning for children with special needs. I'd like to let you know in advance that sometimes I have some problems with my voice, and I think it's just starting now, which is not good. So you may have a little bit of trouble. It may sound sometimes like I'm talking to you through water, but we're going to go ahead, and I hope you find this evening interesting and that you learn something that will be useful to you. I was going to begin by telling you a little bit about myself, but Nancy's already done a lot of that, so I'll just kind of fill in some other things. In addition to being a sole practitioner for most of my legal career, I have also been controller of a machine shop, in-house counsel for the state mental health hospital in Cincinnati, and a member of the faculty of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cincinnati Medical School. I have also been an adjunct in the Department of Economics at the University of Cincinnati, and I have taught online courses for Shepherd Law Broad Center at Nova Southeastern University in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. As Nancy told you, I'm married. I've been married for 33 years. I have two children. Rachel and her family live in Cleveland, and Alex, who has autism, cerebral palsy, and significant developmental delays, lives here in Cincinnati in a condo by himself with 24/7 caregivers. And this is Alex. Alex was born 5 weeks premature And from the start, my wife, who has a master's degree in child study from Tufts, knew there was something very wrong with Alex's development. He was diagnosed with autism and significant developmental delays at age 2.5. He's had a complicated and hard life. He had one surgery to repair a subluxation at C1 and C2 in his neck. That was about not when he was 9. And he had another surgery to fix a broken thigh caused when he fell out of his wheelchair. Despite his autism, the delays, the surgery, he's probably the happiest person I know. He loves to go to the zoo, to see the animals, and especially to ride the train. He loves books, videos, and music. He delights in being able to sit next to me and have me go on the computer and mostly show him YouTube videos of zoo trains, of fireworks, animals, and other things that he really loves. He loves to go to the synagogue every week and especially loves to hear the prayers and the Torah chanted in Hebrew. And even when Alex was very young, he, despite his cognitive delays, has an exceptional memory. And one time the rabbi made a mistake in pointing to a particular page, and Alex, at about 8 years old, corrected the rabbi, told him what page that we should be on. Alex is why I practice in this area of law.
Hey, Paul, I can't see Alex on the slideshow. Did it advance for you?
Do you see it?
No, not yet. Can you go ahead one more slide and maybe back up?
Do you see program for this evening?
It's still on the financial planning for children with autism. Let me refresh my page and see if that changes it. It's not advancing. Let me see. Can you close your slideshow box and click the link again? I'm sorry, folks. Hang on just a second. We'll get the slides advancing for you. Our usual listeners realize that there's always a glitch somewhere along the road.
Okay.
I want to make sure that we've got the visual on you.
I hit a wrong button and went out of my internet program altogether. Waiting for that to...
Just going to take a moment then to pop that back up. In the meantime, I'll let folks know that Paul's the one that helped me drop the special needs trust for my own son. And he's very, very helpful with that.
Now I can't even get my internet to work.
Okay. I can advance the slides for you, but you won't be able to see them unless you're logged into Moms Fighting Autism.
Oh, let's see.
there's always a glitch, isn't there?
Yeah, there's always a glitch.
I'm just going to talk while you fiddle with your computer. I know that in our case, we weren't sure how we would fund the special needs trust because we really didn't have two dimes to run rub together. But as it turns out, we were able to buy life insurance that will fund the trust when we pass on. And, you know, I thought you had to be pretty much independently wealthy to have a special needs trust, but that's not the case at all. You're actually able to fund it upon your death with your life insurance policy. So that really put our minds at ease to know that when we're gone and we can no longer care for Sam, he will be financially taken care of. So I don't know if people would understand that. You don't have to be independently wealthy or have money set aside already to start a special needs trust. Excuse me. You need to reboot your system, Paul?
I think I do.
Okay. Would you go ahead and do that? And I will, while you're rebooting, I will ask you some of the questions that have been submitted. Then we can go into your slideshow.
Okay.
Can you talk and reboot at the same time?
Yes.
Okay. A couple of people have asked about custody situations and how you would set up a trust for a special needs child. It would only be accessible by those that you put in charge of the funds, right?
That's correct.
So it can't be accessed by a non-custodial parent or someone that you don't want to have access to the money.
When you create the trust, part of the creating a trust is deciding who will be in charge of the money, that is, who will be the trustee. And there can be one trustee. There can be several trustees. The trustee can be an individual. It could be a bank or a trust company. So there are different ways of setting up who has control of the special needs trust.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we drew up Sam's trust, our older two children were not yet adults, but we were able to appoint them as trustees, assuming that they would be of age, and they are now, to be able to make those decisions on his behalf.
That's right. A lot of what you do in the planning is making choices that may not be realistic at this point,
mm-hmm.
but you can pick members of the family, and they won't become the trustee should something happen if they're not adults and able to control the money. What would happen in that circumstance would be someone on behalf of the trust would apply to the county probate court for the appointment of a trustee.
Mm-hmm.
And the court would then do that. At least that's the answer here in Ohio.
Right.
As everybody knows, these issues are primarily state issues, and the answer might be different in different states.
And different countries, right?
And certainly the answer is likely to be different in different countries. But the biggest difference may be what the probate court is called, more than an entirely different process. For example, I believe the probate court in New York State is called surrogates court. So for those of you from New York, when we talk about probate court, think surrogate court, because that's the name of the probate court in New York.
So it's different everywhere. You just need to be aware of what your court is called that handles that. But finding a special needs attorney is your first step, right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Someone who actually knows the special needs laws.
I'm not having any luck getting internet access, and I can't figure out why.
Okay. Well,
so
what we've done before in the past when the slideshow wasn't working or wouldn't advance is I would be able to tell you what the slide says as I advance them, and you can talk about it from memory.
Okay.
Do that?
Good. That will work fine.
Okay. I will try to do that. Let's see. Let me take control of the slides. And I will advance them. Okay.
Let's go to program for this evening.
There's tonight's speaker. There's your son, Alex. And program for this evening, discuss special needs trust, concentrate your mind, interview the attorney, and questions. Excuse me, I've had a cold.
Okay. In this webinar, I'm going to discuss special needs trusts, what they are, and how to use them for the benefit of a child with autism or any other disability that will likely interfere with his or her ability to earn a living as an adult. I'm also going to address concentrating your mind, and you'll find out what I mean by that later. Next, I will talk a little bit about interviewing an attorney. And if time permits, I might be able to address some tax issues as well. Finally, as is typical, Nancy will ask me questions, and I hope that I'm able to give good answers to them. So let's start. What is a special needs trust? Next slide.
Uh-huh. You're right.
Trusts were first used hundreds of years ago. Trusts were and still are used to control how future generations use the riches of the current generation. For example, a father might create a trust for his children, specifying that his sons would only get their share of the income of the trust until they married and had a child. This same trust would allow his daughters to receive only income from the trust, and their shares would remain in the trust until it could be distributed to a male heir through the daughter's lineage. Now, obviously, these kinds of issues have led to a lot of litigation, something that can unfortunately split families and cost a lot of money. Special needs trusts were first created in recent times to take advantage of government benefits available to the disabled while not spending all of a family's assets on that child. Next slide.
All righty.
In developing a special needs plan, the parents and the attorney need to examine many factors. What are the assets of the parents? What are the assets, if any, of the grandparents and other interested relatives? Are there other children? will the child with autism be able to earn a living on his own? If a decision is made that a special needs estate plan is appropriate, I typically recommend the following plan in developing the special needs estate plan. Next slide.
Mm-hmm.
I usually suggest the parents create a living trust, which serves as the repository of the family's assets. Life insurance proceeds would be made payable to the trust. The living trust is created so that it becomes an irrevocable sprinkle trust, so it can sprinkle money into the special needs trust that you can see on the right-hand side of the screen as needed, and can sprinkle money to the trusts of other children if they are under a certain age, or if the children, or to the children if they are older. One of the reasons that I do this and that I suggest that the estate plan have this family trust and special needs trust is that each child that has autism is an entirely different person than the next child with autism. Your child might love to go on vacations. Alex would not want to go on a vacation if his life depended on it. You might need money for furnishings for the living space, or you might not. So the amount of money that any particular special needs trust needs to have in it can vary greatly from one child to the next. Next slide. As you saw in the previous slide, there are primarily three kinds of trusts I use in this kind of estate plan: the living trust, the special needs trust, and the sibling trust. As you can see, there are three kinds of special needs trusts that I might use: the first party payback trust, the third party special needs trust, and the pooled trusts. Next slide.
Okay.
A living trust typically is used primarily as a means to minimize the involvement of probate. And you've all seen advertisements for living trusts, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Trusts are not just for people trying to avoid estate taxes or avoid probate. While most people don't need to do estate tax planning, living trusts can play an important role in financial planning for children with autism. Next slide. A living trust is often used as an intermediate step to shield unnecessary money from flowing into the special needs trust. What is unnecessary money? Excuse me. Suppose you have a $300,000 life insurance policy. It may not make sense to dump all of that $300,000 into the special needs trust upon the death of the insured. As I just briefly mentioned, your child may love to take vacations, mine doesn't, so why fund a special needs trust with money that is not going to be needed? This plan of using the living trust as an intermediate step is designed to meet two goals. Next slide.
Okay.
It keeps too much money from going into the special needs trust at one time. And two, if the special needs trust laws or regulations change, it minimizes the amount of money at risk that may have to be paid back to the government. The way the federal law is currently written, the government has chosen to allow special needs trusts not to be counted as a resource of the disabled individual. When this individual turns 18 and applies for government benefits, the federal government looks at the amount of resources the individual has to decide eligibility for Supplemental Security Income, known as SSI, and the state government looks at the amount of countable resources to decide eligibility for Medicaid. Most states set the level to qualify for Medicaid at the same level Social Security uses to determine eligibility for SSI. There are, however, many states that set a higher threshold for Medicaid eligibility than the federal government sets for SSI. In this day of debt crisis mentality, I would not be surprised if some states or the federal government may eventually change the eligibility criteria and may even decide to count special needs trusts as an available resource. So one of the purposes that the Living Trust serves is to create a step above the Special Needs Trust. So if the Special Needs Trusts start being counted as an asset of the individual, most of the money the special needs child needs for supplemental services is not held in the Special Needs Trust. It's held in the Living Trust. This may provide some protection from the reach of governments hungry to decimate spending for the poor and the disabled, and the general population's hunger for smaller government and decreased government spending. Next page. Next slide. The First Party Payback Trust is one of the trusts provided for under federal law. If the person with special needs has too much money in his or her own name to qualify for SSI or Medicaid, it is possible to draft a payback trust into which to deposit those assets. This kind of trust requires a provision first to pay back Medicaid for medical assistance out of the remainder of the trust. So this type of trust is used to shield assets owned by the individual applying for or receiving government benefits. Perhaps the individual inherits some money while he or she is already receiving benefits. That inheritance could cost that individual his or her eligibility for the benefits being received. So what we can do is draft a payback trust. The government is willing to refrain from stopping the benefits until the person spends down the asset back to the original eligibility amount. But it wants to get paid back for the Medicaid money it has spent in the meantime. So the payback trust requires a provision in the trust that the trustee pay Medicaid back out of the remainder of the trust when the trust is no longer in use. That is, whatever money is left in that payback trust when it is to be dissolved. The First Party Payback Trust is often referred to as a D4A trust because it's subsection D4A of the part of the Social Security law that provides for these kinds of trusts. Next slide, please. A third-party trust is used when the assets of the trust are deposited by anyone other than the special needs individual. The assets may come from parents, relatives, or other trusts, as long as the assets do not come from the first party, the individual who the benefit of these monies are intended. the remainder of the third-party trust is not required to be used to pay Medicaid back. The third-party trust is the most typical of the special needs trusts. It is usually created by a child's parents or another relative. The basic requirements of this trust are it may not contain any assets of the person for whom the trust was established. It must have one or more trustees. It must give the trustee complete discretion about how to spend the money in the trust. It must not provide any standard to guide the trustee's discretion. A typical standard that you might see in a husband and wife trust where there is no special needs trust is the wording comfort, maintenance, and support. Now, that's not much of a standard. It's hard to quantify that, but it is a standard. And so a special needs trust cannot have that kind of language in it. The special needs trust cannot say the trustee shall provide money for the beneficiary to have a comfortable life. The trustee must have complete discretion. Finally, the trust must designate remainder beneficiaries of the trust after it is no longer in use. And it should contain what is known as a poison pill. The poison pill is a provision in the trust that requires the trust to terminate if it is ever deemed to be a countable resource for determining eligibility for government benefits. Most third-party trusts contain other provisions, such as who will be the individual's guardian if one is needed and the parents are not competent or no longer alive. Special needs trusts must closely follow the law's requirements. And while the federal government sets up the primary requirements, states might have different requirements in each state. And this is one reason why not just any attorney or even any estate planning attorney can draft special needs trusts. They may not be aware of the particular rules and designs of special needs trusts. Next slide, please. Another type of special needs trust is called a pooled trust. These are nonprofit organizations that literally pool the money of clients in order to minimize costs and maximize income. Pooled trusts are not the best choice for every kind of special needs trust, but they play an important role for some kinds of special needs trusts. Pooled trusts are sometimes referred to as D4C trusts. If a family does not have a reasonable choice for a trustee, a pooled trust provides trust services for a relatively nominal cost. Not all pooled trusts are the same, nor are they required to be the same. Some states only have one pooled trust organization in the state, while others may have two, three, or more pooled trusts that operate in that state. In Ohio, I know of three pooled trusts, and I believe there may even be a fourth. The best use of a pooled trust, in my view, is when a payback trust must be used and there is little time to have one drafted. If you are interested in a pooled trust, your attorney should be able to help you decide which one is the best choice for you, not some financial advisor or some employee of one of the pooled trusts itself. Next slide, please. in the diagram that we looked at a little bit ago, there was the sibling trusts or others, the remainder beneficiaries. A sibling trust is designed to provide maximum flexibility in moving money to family members who don't have disabilities. It also serves, or can serve, as the remainder beneficiary of the special needs trust. A sibling trust is simply my name for other trusts created for minor children in the family. A great majority of parents want the remainder from the special needs trust to stay in the family. If the individual with autism has brothers and sisters who are under 18, a trust should be drafted for each one in case a need arises to terminate a special needs trust prior to the time that all siblings turn at least 18. Now, this again becomes an issue that needs to be considered, especially today, given the emphasis on the country's debt and the problems that state governments have in getting enough funds to provide services themselves. So if a special needs trust becomes a countable resource in order to knock as many people as possible off of SSI, off of Medicaid, those trusts that have a poison pill are going to have to terminate. And the remainder beneficiaries will either be sibling trusts or siblings themselves. So you want to, if you're just starting now or even thinking about modifying what you currently have, this is an issue that needs to be discussed. Of course, while the attorney is drafting the sibling trusts, many parents like to spread out the distribution over a number of years. Typically, the final distribution may not occur until the child turns 30 or 35. So this is especially true if the sibling is not very good at handling money and the parent already knows that. Okay, next slide, please. This is back to the diagram that we put up a few slides previously. We talked about this possible option. Okay. The husband and the wife would each have wills. Their wills would leave their assets, ultimately, to the family living trust. When the husband and the wife are both deceased, the family living trust becomes an irrevocable sprinkle trust. And the trustee of that trust has the ability to sprinkle principal or income or both among the special needs trust and the siblings. Now, it's entirely possible that a particular family might have two special needs trusts for their child with autism. There might be a first-party payback trust and a third-party special needs trust. You don't want money going into the first-party payback trust, and you want to use those assets first because you want to avoid having to pay money back to the government. So sometimes there will be two, perhaps even a third pooled trust might be in play, if you will. Note, now you see the arrow going from the special needs trust to the sibling trusts slash others. And above that is the word remainder. One of those requirements of a special needs trust is that the remainder beneficiary be identified. Sometimes, or usually, the remainder beneficiary will be other children or other family members. The remainder beneficiaries, however, could include charities, other people in the family, other important people, for whatever reason, however the parent chooses to set up the plan. In Ohio, where I practice, there is another kind of special needs trust. The Ohio legislature has created a statutory supplemental needs trust. And in order to create one of these, it's created through the will of an individual, and the individual leaves money to this statutory trust, and it has to be drafted specifically according to the state statute. So there are at least four different kinds of special needs trusts. Most people don't use the statutory trust. Other states might have statutory trusts. Many states probably don't. But it is something that in doing an estate plan, you need to give some consideration to. The next slide, please. Government benefits. When we talk about government benefits, we're talking about means-tested benefits. That is, the eligibility criteria is based upon two things: whether the individual is disabled according to Social Security criteria, and usually a child with autism is deemed to meet the Social Security disability criteria, and two, whether the individual has countable assets under a certain figure, typically $1,500, perhaps $2,000. Other government benefits, like Social Security disability income or Medicare, are not means-tested benefits. So if, for example, you are the parent of a 55-year-old child with autism who is not able to support himself, when you qualify for Social Security, either because you get disabled and you yourself qualify for Social Security disability income, or you reach 62 or 65 or 66 and start drawing your Social Security, your 50-plus-year-old adult child then qualifies for Social Security disability income irrespective of how much money he or she has control over himself. But SSI, Medicaid, food stamps, and housing are all means-tested benefits, and the individual has to meet those two eligibility requirements of being disabled and having countable assets under a certain figure. Next slide, please. Concentrate your mind. I hope the section on special needs trusts was clear enough to give you some background to be able to discuss the topic with an attorney or some other professional that you choose to work with. Now I'd like to talk about concentrating your mind, and you'll see why. Next slide. When a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully. Yes? Knowing that you're going to be hanged in 14 days certainly would make one sit up and pay attention to what he needs to do in the remaining 14 days of his life to put his affairs in order. Next slide. In order to prepare an estate plan, whether solely for yourself or your family, or to provide for a child with autism or other special needs, you must be able to concentrate your mind to make sure that all the necessary parts of the plan come together. But it also means that in order for you to be ready to consult with an attorney about drafting an estate plan, you need to be ready to concentrate, because there are any number of decisions that you will need to make. Next slide. So the primary question for me is, what will it take to concentrate your mind? That is, what will it take to get you started immediately to put a special needs estate plan in place? Next slide. Why is this so important? Why should you do this now and not in a few months or a few years? Next slide. A person who knows she will die in 2 months still has some time to put her affairs in order. Next slide. But a person who might die tomorrow from a heart attack or a work accident or be hit by a bus does not have time to spare. If you have a son or daughter with autism or some other disability that will likely affect his or her ability to earn a living, you don't have time to spare. Most people aren't suicidal and don't know when they are going to die. But people, even young people, in the prime of their lives, may lose the ability to create an estate plan, whether because they die unexpectedly or they become incompetent to make financial decisions or to make a will or a trust. Many people who are alive, obviously, don't have the mental capacity to make a will, to create a trust, to create a power of attorney. And that can happen because of age. It could happen because of disease. It could happen because of some kind of an accident. Next slide. So I ask each of you participating in this webinar, do you have an estate plan in place? And if not, why not? If not, do you even know why you don't? Has it been a conscious decision not to do so, or an unconscious decision simply because you haven't gotten around to it? Next slide. Are you someone who, like the ostrich, sticks your head in the sand, hoping everything will take care of itself? It won't take care of itself, I promise. Next slide. Or are you like the vast majority of parents with a child with autism who thinks you can't face the issue of creating an estate plan? Creating an estate plan with a special needs trust and a child with autism can be a very haunting experience. Nonetheless, you must face it. You must make the decisions necessary for your attorney to to draft the plan. Next slide. Or do you think you don't have the money to do this now? If so, just think how much it will cost to unravel your life if you die without an estate plan. If you die without a will, the state makes the decision about how your assets will be distributed. And your spouse and children may be negatively affected by the laws in your state. Each state has a default provision called a statute of descent and distribution that designates how your assets are to be divided if you die without a will. Many states have these statutes that will require your child with autism to inherit some of your assets. The states do not uniformly require that all of one spouse's assets go to the other spouse. Many states, typically, where there is a spouse and minor children, give the spouse one-third of the spouse's estate and the surviving children two-thirds to be divided amongst the children. So here's the possibility that if you don't create an estate plan and a special needs trust, and if you die without a will, your state may require a payback trust to be created, and you're going to spend the money, or your spouse will spend the money, even though you don't think that you are able to afford to create a special needs estate plan. Next slide. If your mind isn't concentrated enough yet to take action, let me tell you some more things that might help. Next slide. What is the primary concern of parents of a special needs child? Why have those of you participating tonight who have a child with autism or some other disability decide to spend this time at this webinar? I'm sure you have lots of other things that you could be doing with this time, but you've chosen to spend this time learning about financial planning for children with autism. You're concerned about the special needs child and what will happen. Next slide. What will happen to my child when we are not here to take care of her? Every parent worries about this question, whether they have an estate plan or not. It is something you cannot completely control, but an estate plan takes things about as far as you are able to take them. Without a plan, only a court will decide what happens to your child. And that's something that none of us want to see happen. I worry about what's going to happen to Alex when my wife and I are gone. I worry about what impact that's going to have on our daughter who lives in Cleveland and who has children of her own. Whether you have an estate plan or not, it is something that we all think about all the time. So at least make sure that those things that you can control are taken care of. And what you can control is putting an estate plan in place. Next slide, please. These are some of the things that you're thinking about. Who will care for her when we're gone? Will she have enough money to meet her needs? Where will she live? Next slide. What kind of life will she be able to lead? What can I expect of my other children? And is this fair to them? And I think we can add another issue is what happens if the government starts counting special needs trusts as a countable resource and my child loses his or her government benefits? Next slide, please. Now, have I concentrated your mind enough yet? Will you take that important next step and start working on your estate plan now? No? Let's go farther.
No, next. I don't want to.
Yeah. Next slide. What are some other questions that parents may need help answering? Next slide. What if you're faced with this situation? My parents want to put Sarah in their will. What effect might that have on their eligibility to receive SSI or Medicaid? You should already know the answer to this if you've been able to retain some of the things that I've gone over much too quickly. If your parents have the financial means to do something for your child with autism, there is a right way and a wrong way to use that advantage. Putting your child into their will is clearly the wrong way. Instead, they can gift money or leave money in their wills to his or her special needs trust, but only if you've set one up. If your parents can afford to do so, they might pay the premiums on a new life insurance policy to help answer the question of whether your child will have enough money to meet his needs. Some insurance companies sell a particular type of policy called a second-to-die policy. Some insurance companies have a similar but different policy. Other insurance companies don't offer a second-to-die policy at all. A second-to-die policy is my preference. And what it means is that it pays the insurance benefits only when the second person who is insured under the policy dies. As a result of that, because of the actuarial tables and how insurance companies calculate their premiums, a second-to-die policy buys more insurance or costs you less money. Your financial advisor, not your attorney, though, may have other advice that fits your situation better. This is my preference. It's one that I have, and it has served us well. And I would recommend that you discuss this with your financial advisor. Next slide, please. Every parent wants to be fair to all their children. But Emily will probably need more money than the others. How do I work this out and still feel good about it? That's a hard question. But one answer is that equal isn't necessarily fair. There are ways to work around the idea and arrive at a solution that you are comfortable with. If Emily needs more money, is there a way to do that still allows you in your will or trust setup to forge things in a particular way that will provide sufficient, if not equal, money to your other children while still providing your child with autism a sufficient amount of money for his supplemental services. That's why you need to get started, to find professionals that will help you wrestle with these concepts if you haven't done so yet. And if you have done so, you may want to revisit the ideas that you have, the steps that you've taken so far with your professionals, and see maybe if you want to change some of your estate plan. Next slide, please. One way to start answering these and other questions is to find a qualified attorney to lead the way to find the appropriate mix of people you need on your team. You will need a team, and you have to start somewhere. As an attorney, I prefer that you start with an attorney. But you may already have a financial advisor who can help you find a qualified attorney or other members of your team. So you don't have to start with an attorney, even if you don't have that financial advisor. You may choose to start with a financial advisor and think about some of the funding issues and the financial issues that you're going to need to address at some point anyway. But, as I said, I prefer suggesting that you start with an attorney. Next slide. The attorney's job will be to draft your estate plan, help you find a financial advisor if you don't have one, and help you find other members of your team if you need other members. And if you live in the Dayton area, you'd probably do well to give Nancy a call, and she could probably do just as much for you and pointing you in the right direction as any other person that I know. Next slide, please.
I say call Paul.
The attorney also will need to advise you of any changes in the law to ensure your estate plan provides the legal protections that your child needs. Every special needs trust should contain provisions that your trustee should consult with a qualified attorney at the expense of the trust to make sure that the trustee's actions are in compliance with the law, or that other steps may need to be taken because of a change in the law. Only an attorney can advise you about the law. All too frequently, I find that when others try to advise people about what the law requires, they miss some nuance that a qualified special needs attorney would not miss. That's aside from the fact that giving advice about what the law requires is practicing law, and if you're not an attorney and you're giving advice, legal advice, that's not a good position to be in. Next slide. It is important to get started because the process can be time-consuming. You will need to find, next slide, an executor for your will, one or more trustees to ensure your trusts are handled properly, perhaps a guardian for your child, no matter what his age. Not only will you need to find these individuals, but you probably will need to find successors or substitutes. What happens if you appoint an executor in your will and that executor dies and you haven't changed your will to replace that person? So your will, your trust, ought to provide for some way of having successor executors, successor trustees, and perhaps successor guardians. And there are various ways of doing this that include naming several people. Some people that I have drafted wills and trusts for name three people: a primary trustee, the first successor trustee, and a second successor trustee. As a matter of my practice, I typically add a provision in all of my clients' wills and trusts, or in trusts particularly, that give the last named successor trustee the right to appoint in the future his or her successor. Because that person might be the trustee for 20 years after you're gone, and you couldn't have begun to be in a position to think about who in 40 years is going to become the trustee. Excuse me. So I've put into place in my trusts procedures in the trust to ensure that trustees can always appoint future trustees, so that if your child with autism lives to the ripe old age of 100 and outlives several trustees, there's still going to be a way to get a new trustee appointed that knows your child, that has some interest in your child, that will care about your child. The alternative is going to probate court or surrogate court, whatever it's called, and asking the judge to appoint a trustee. And all that's likely to get you is the appointment of some CPA or some friend of the judge's that doesn't know your child, has no idea what is going on in your child's life, may not even understand the whole issue of autism or Down syndrome or Prader-Willi syndrome or any of the other varieties of disabilities that I see in my practice. So this is a way that you can be fairly sure that you're going to continue to have a trustee that's going to know what's best for your child. And as I say that, it reminds me of something that I have not discussed previously, and that unfortunately I left out of this presentation. And that is something that most of you probably have heard about, and it's called a letter of intent. A letter of intent is not a legal document like a will or a trust, but it's a document nonetheless. Usually it will come, and there are lots of them around. You could probably see them, find them on the internet if you're not aware of what I'm talking about. What the letter of intent does is it leads you through your child's life in various steps so that you can tell somebody who comes behind you as the guardian or the trustee what your child likes to eat, where your child likes to go for vacations, if he wants to go on a vacation. What kind of medications is he taking? Who his doctors are? And on and on. It's a document, and I've seen five or six different kinds of letters of intent, and they all do pretty much the same thing, and that is put down in one place critical information about your child that the casual observer or even your brothers or sisters may not know, but that are important for that health and welfare of your child. And your attorney and your financial advisor should have access to letters of intent and should provide you with a letter of intent so that you can fill it out and hopefully review it annually and make changes where appropriate as your child grows and matures, so the most current information can be available. And don't think that I'm not aware that Nancy is the moderator of this, and I may well be telling you to do things that I didn't tell her to do when I
did her statement. Oh, I'm making notes. Don't you worry.
Yeah, okay. All right. Well, good. Good. Because while I have been drafting special needs trusts since 1993, I learn new things all the time about strategies and language to improve my special needs trust plan package. And there's lots of boilerplate, if you will, typical language that goes into trusts, one after another after another, that's general, that's created to fulfill some legal requirement, and rarely gets looked at from one year to the next by attorneys that draft trusts and wills and do estate planning. And I will admit that I don't always look at everyone carefully, but I do it frequently enough that I can guarantee you that the trust that I'm writing today is going to be somehow different than the trust that I wrote last month, because there may have been changes in the law, there have been changes in the way I think about things. I have had questions from parents that no previous parent has ever asked me before. And all of these things get molded and folded into my new plans. And I keep updating them. So, Nancy, you're welcome to ship me back your plan, and I'll take a look at it.
It's already in the works.
Okay. All right. Next slide.
Okay.
Interview the prospective attorney. I don't know how many of you have even thought about the possibility that you can make an appointment with an attorney to discuss some legal issue, special needs estate plan, and you go in and talk to the attorney, and you are free to walk away from that person and choose another attorney. There's nothing that requires you to use any doctor, any financial advisor, any attorney, just because you've made an appointment. Interview the lawyer. Next slide. Most attorneys, even those who regularly draft estate plans, don't know the basics of special needs planning. Meet with the attorney and interview him or her. any attorney worth hiring will not be offended. Any attorney worth hiring will not be offended at being interviewed by a prospective client. If you want a second opinion and the attorney tries to present stumbling blocks to keep you from doing that, you've probably chosen the wrong person to talk to in the first place. Next slide. Find out, for example, how long the attorney has been involved in special needs trust planning. Ask why the attorney does special needs planning. To me, these seem to be reasonable matters to be discussed. But just because the attorney hasn't been writing special needs estate plans for a long time doesn't mean he or she is not qualified to do so. You need to dig deeper. Next slide. Ask the attorney to explain the difference between different kinds of special needs trusts. I have given you some basics about the different types of special needs trusts. With that knowledge, and you can go back at some other time to go back through the presentation, through the slides, to bolster what we talked about, you can tell if the attorney knows what he or she is talking about. Even if the attorney came highly recommended, and even if the attorney belongs to all kinds of professional organizations, if he or she can't tell you that there are payback trusts and third-party trusts, you need to go elsewhere. If the attorney cannot even give you the basics of what a pooled trust is, go somewhere else. Next slide. If you don't get satisfactory answers, if the chemistry isn't right, or if the attorney only uses one type of trust in every situation, don't hire that attorney, even if you may ultimately choose the trust that attorney always uses. There's a difference between the three types of trusts, or four even, that we've talked about. No one type of trust fits all situations, and any attorney that tries to fit every situation into one type of trust is not somebody that you should be hiring. Next slide. Here again, I brought you back to my typical trust. You might decide not to use a living trust. You might decide to use a pooled trust or leave the entire remainder with that pooled trust to benefit other people with autism. You are the client. You are paying for the attorney's services. You get to decide what's best for you and your family. And the attorney that you hire should draft the trust and your wills the way you want, or you and the attorney should not be working together. Now, it's possible that what you want is not possible to be done under the law. And the attorney ought to tell you that. And if the attorney believes that, then he or she should not prepare your plan. They may be wrong. What you are wanting might actually be perfectly legal. But if the attorney doesn't understand it, you don't want them to do your work. But if you want something other than the attorney suggests, if you want something other than what my typical trust plan is, I'm happy to do that for you, as should any attorney. So there's a few minutes left before we we're into questions, and I would like to take just a little time to discuss some tax issues that may be relevant to you and your family. I have gotten a lot of questions about whether ABA therapy, applied behavioral analysis therapy, can be deducted as a medical expense on Schedule A of your tax return. The answer to that is probably. In order to deduct something as a medical expense, you should have a doctor's prescription or letter or something in writing signed by the doctor that advises ABA therapy as a treatment that will help alleviate some of the symptoms of your child's autism. The second requirement is that it is something that makes your child's life better or does alleviate some of the symptoms. And so my understanding of ABA, and it's my understanding is fairly superficial, but my understanding of ABA is that if you get a doctor to advise it, you can take the cost of it off of your taxes on Schedule A as a medical expense if you meet all the other requirements. And this goes for a lot of other things that you might need to do. I had a client whose daughter was in a wheelchair, and her bedroom was on the second floor. She couldn't get up to the second floor without an elevator. The family put an elevator into their house for their daughter. They did it in such a way, though, they put it through a shaft between a small half bath on the first floor and a closet on the second floor. And the test when you make modifications to your home is that if the modification does not increase the market value of your home, and if it is to help someone who has a disability, you can deduct the cost of putting the elevator in as a medical expense, because that's exactly what it is. If the elevator costs $10,000, but it increases the fair market value of your home by $5,000, you can write off the other $5,000. So there are lots of things that we do in our everyday life that are particularly expensive and that we would like to be able to write off on our taxes if we can, that we really can. Another thing is that you can deduct mileage for doctor's appointments and therapy appointments and other medical travel. So if you're in a situation where you're always taking your child with autism to a therapist, to the doctor, to the hospital for tests here or there, and if you keep track of that by putting down your starting mileage and your ending mileage and the date, and you keep track of all of that, that can also be applied on your Schedule A as a medical expense. And all of those things might add up to the point where you'll actually be able to get a deduction for your medical expenses if you itemize your deductions. Okay, Nancy, I think let's start with questions.
Oh, I have a ton. But I'm going to let our callers know that if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 2 on your telephone, and that will alert me that you have a question, and you can ask Paul your question live. In the meantime, I had sent you some questions, Paul. Were any of those something you wanted to address before I go, the questions that have come in while you've been talking?
There was one question. In the case of a difficult divorce situation, how can you ensure that the funds in the trust will be used solely for the needs of the child and not for an ex-spouse who may try to access the funds for his or her own purpose? Well, there are a couple of ways to do that. One way is to have co-trustees. If you and your ex-spouse are co-trustees and the account requires two signatures, then no money can be spent out of that account without both people agreeing. Another way might be to have co-trustees that aren't either of the two spouses, ex-spouses, but two other people, one from each family or something of that sort, or maybe two people that they each can agree on are responsible and won't collude to divert the money. You can always choose an institutional trustee like a bank or an investment company, and they will make sure that something like that doesn't happen. But another issue about divorce that I have talked about in other places is that if you have a child with autism and you're involved in a divorce, that is unfortunately, but a good situation where you have some leverage to force your soon-to-be ex-spouse to cooperate and have a special needs estate plan drafted that will address the needs of your child with autism. You can push it, not completely, and you know, but you can push that pretty far probably in order to make sure that your child is well taken care of, because after your divorce is done, you have nowhere to go to have both spouses involved in financing the special needs trust.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, complicated and interesting.
Yeah,
we have a guest on the phone who would like to ask you a question. Let me unmute.
Hello.
Hi, you had a question?
Oh, yes, I did. Is it me?
You're on.
Okay, great. I've enjoyed your presentation. It's been very, very, very informative.
My question
was about the annual review you suggested about a trust. I currently don't have one, but I you've ignited the need to do that. But when you review them annually, is there a fee for that if you update it? Each year, or is it part of an annual review that you can set up? Like, what are the fees involved in counseling over that?
Well, I think that's an issue that you would need to address with your own particular attorney. While I might charge a certain fee that might fit with my practice and my overhead and so forth, that may not be what somebody else would charge. But I will tell you a story. Somebody asked me about guardianship. One of the earlier questions asked me about guardianship. I had a call from a woman who asked me about guardianship and what she needed to do and how much I charged. And she lived in Butler County, which is the county immediately north of Cincinnati, of Hamilton County, where I live. I spent 15 minutes on the phone with the woman and walked her through the paperwork that I would have otherwise prepared, and told her that in Butler County, as in most counties in Ohio, and I don't know the situation in other states, you don't need an attorney to do a guardianship. You can do it yourself, and the people in the probate court are happy to try to help as much as they can without practicing law. She said, oh, that's great. How much do I owe you? And I said, nothing. And she said, oh, I just talked to another attorney who wanted $1,500. So back to your question, I would charge a relatively nominal amount, and I think that's reasonable. If somebody wants $1,500 to do it, that's way out of the ballpark.
Okay. Thank you for that. One additional question on that same point is, do you revise the trust and you had something that wasn't in it legally and you need to add it? That's just something you handle with the lawyer to review that and make an update.
Sometimes you can just do an amendment to the trust. Just recites that you're changing Article 4 to read and just do Article 4. Sometimes you have to redo the whole thing. But most of the time, you can make changes by simply amending the will or the trust.
Okay, and thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Thank you. If there's anyone else that would like to ask a question, just press star 2 and I'll get you connected. In the meantime, Well, I was going to ask Paul, what typically happens if you don't have a will or a trust?
If you don't have a will, each state has a law of descent and distribution that mandates how your estate is to be divided up. Some states transfer the money to the surviving spouse. Other states give the surviving spouse half if there's one child, and the child half. If there's more than one child, the surviving spouse gets a third, and the children get two-thirds.
Mm-hmm. And what would happen then with the individual with the disability, do you think, typically?
What would happen is that person would then all of a sudden have some assets that would require either the preparation of a payback trust, or if the person isn't thinking and doesn't realize it, it's going to knock the child off of getting benefits until that money is paid back down to the $1,500, $2,000 range that's generally applicable in the various states. So
would they become a ward of the state no matter their age, or?
No.
No, okay.
No, as long as there's a surviving spouse, the surviving spouse would continue to either be the natural guardian if they were under 18, or if the surviving spouse had been appointed a guardian, they would continue as the guardian.
Mm-hmm. What if they're the only surviving spouse or the only surviving parent? A family member?
If there are no surviving spouse, someone would have to apply to the probate court to be appointed guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And that person typically would be a family member. But, you know, if you live in an area and you don't have any parents still alive, and your closest relative is in another state, it's a potential mess.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it. It's truly worth the hassle of drawing up the correct documents and everything.
It really is.
I had a friend approach me and ask, she said that she had gone into the bank and wanted to open a trust, and they didn't understand what she wanted. It's not like a savings account.
Correct? No, it's not. No, it's not. Your friend just may have gone into a branch of a bank,
mm-hmm.
and gotten someone who wasn't well versed in the bank's procedures. What typically happens when someone goes into a bank to open a trust account, the bank will ask for a copy of the trust to find out if the trust is revocable or irrevocable, to find out if the person opening the account is indeed the trustee and entitled to open the account. And if so, then they will go ahead and open the account. The issue of revocable versus irrevocable is primarily one of tax implications. A revocable trust is usually taxed to the beneficiary of the trust. So if a client created a revocable trust for the client's two children, the bank would want the two children's social security numbers, and it would report to the children and to IRS what the earnings were for that year to each child, so they would report it on their tax return. An irrevocable trust is a taxpayer in and of itself, and it must have its own tax identification number. An irrevocable trust gets taxed at the highest levels of the tax system that we have in the United States. There's a small exemption, depending upon certain language in the trust. It could either be $100 or $300. So if the trust earns $5,000 in income, it's going to pay tax on probably $4,900 of income. And it's going to be taxed at not too bad a rate. I think the rate is only 15%. But when you get over $10,000 of taxable adjusted income, the rate jumps to 35%. So if there's a reasonable amount of money in a trust that's, and it's earning more than $10,000, it's going to pay a significant amount of tax. The exception to that is when an irrevocable trust pays money on behalf of a beneficiary, that money is deductible by the trust on its tax return, and the beneficiary should get a 1099 form that tells the beneficiary how much money he or she needs to declare as income on his or her tax return.
Mm-hmm.
So the short answer, the simple answer is the bank screwed up. You need to take the trust into the bank. The trustee does. They will set up the account. If it's an irrevocable trust, you need to have a new tax ID number for the trust. And if it's a revocable trust, as most living trusts are, you can just give the bank the social security number of, if it's a couple, of one of the couple's social security numbers or the beneficiary's social security number. But the trustee is not going to be liable for the income, not going to have to claim the income on the trustee's tax return.
Okay. So are you saying that trust accounts can earn interest?
Yes.
Can grow? Okay.
Yes. In fact, that's one of the obligations of the trustee is to invest the money in the trust wisely.
I've had people ask me, Grandma wants to give birthday money to little Billy, you know, Christmas money, birthday money. They don't want to jeopardize anything that he could potentially, you know, benefit from, government benefits, so they don't want to go over that 1,500 or 2,000 threshold. Should a trust account, an account be opened for that money to go into?
Probably not, unless it's a lot, unless it's significantly more. If it's $5,000 or $10,000, there ought to be a trust in place, and there ought to be a trust account that invests the money. What you want to try to avoid is having Uniform Gift to Minor Act or Uniform Transfer to Minor Act accounts that when the child with autism gets older and the money has accumulated, you're going to have to create a payback trust to be able to qualify for government benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be more than that $1,500, $2,000.
So in the meantime, just a regular child's bank account would be fine?
As long as you're spending it on behalf, as long as you're spending it for things for the child.
Mm-hmm.
Buying toys, paying for a vacation, doing something with it so that it doesn't accumulate and become a problem.
Okay.
Otherwise, when the child turns 18, you're going to have to, just before the child turns 18, you're going to have to create a payback trust for what might be a relatively small amount of money. And that might be a good use of a pooled trust for smaller amounts of money so that you don't have to go to the expense of creating a payback trust. But I've had clients that are well-to-do enough that the small savings account for the child has $50,000 or $100,000 in it.
Okay. How about accounts that grandparents typically open, college funds?
Okay. If it's a 529 plan, the 529 college plan belongs to the person who is putting the money in. It does not belong to the potential college attendee. So if the grandparents start a 529 plan for child one when he or she is born, and it builds up, and child one then gets diagnosed with autism, and as that person gets older, if he or she doesn't go to college, the grandparents can change the beneficiary of that account to child two or child three. So the money isn't lost. Lost is not the right word, because they can always take the money back. It's just that they would have to repay the tax savings that they were able to take when they put money into the 529 plan.
Okay. And how about if the individual with the disability is an adult? The trust has been established. Everything is going great. They're getting government benefits. What about their income? Can their income go into the trust if they're earning an income?
No.
Okay.
No. Their money, if they're earning an income, and by the way, the individual is allowed to earn up to $1,000 a month without being disqualified from collecting means-tested benefits, SSI or Medicaid. If it's their money, it cannot go into a third-party trust that their parents or their grandparents set up. It has to go into a payback trust if it's going to be put into a trust situation, if it's not going to be spent on a regular basis.
Okay.
But it's going to be accumulated.
Does something like this exist where there's maybe a database of special needs attorneys or someplace folks can go to find a special needs attorney?
There are a couple of organizations that charge a fee to belong to for attorneys that do special needs trusts. Offhand, I forget the name of the organization. There's another organization called National Alliance of Elder Law Attorneys, NAELA, and they have a website. And most elder law attorneys also do special needs trusts, because a lot of what an elder law attorney does mimics what a special needs trust attorney does. And so you will frequently find special needs trust attorneys belong to the NAELA. I do.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good source for special needs attorneys.
And it's
you might find somebody who doesn't do it, but that would be certainly the exception rather than the rule.
And the organization, again, is the NAE?
L-A. National Association or National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys.
Okay. I found you through MetLife.
Yes.
That's how I got started.
Yeah. The Met Desk is a good resource for special needs information. They're very active in the disabled population. You may find it at other insurance company
mm-hmm.
sites as well. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, there are other insurance agencies that have a special needs planning division.
Yes.
I just happened to go through the Met Desk because it had Snoopy and it was not intimidating.
Right. 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 Exactly.
It can be scary, and Snoopy was very comforting.
Yeah, I can understand that. I have a question that I would like to address.
Yes, sir.
Here's a question that came in earlier. This person has a 6-year-old with autism, and he is self-employed, and he is thinking about employing his son when he turns 8 and paying him a salary for the next 10 years so that he can make contributions to Social Security and Medicare. So when the son turns 18, he will qualify for Medicare and Social Security for life. He wants his son to have Medicare instead of Medicaid, and he's thinking about paying him $18,500 with $16,500 going to a 401k. He asks if that's possible. The answer to that is, I'm not sure if it's possible, but it's a bad idea, even if it is possible. First of all, if in order to qualify for Social Security disability income, you have to be disabled. And if you have been earning $18,000, which is more than $1,000 a month, you're not going to be able to convince Social Security that this person who was on your payroll yesterday is now totally disabled. So it's going in the exact opposite direction of where you ought to be going. Secondly, for someone who does qualify as an individual whose parents have started taking Social Security disability, the Medicare that he wants doesn't start for the first 24 months. Otherwise, it doesn't start until you turn 65. So he's got some interesting ideas, but they don't work. So if he's listening, or if anybody else is thinking along these lines, this is not what you want to do. You're taking your child, and just because someone has autism doesn't necessarily mean that they're not going to be able to earn a living. Everybody in the autism community knows Temple Grandin and knows that she is the world's expert in stockyard design. She's not going to qualify for SSI and Medicaid. She'll qualify for Medicare when she turns 65. So there are levels of autism that that is different from certain other kinds of diseases, where if you have this kind of problem, you are never going to not be disabled.
Let me ask you this.
Please?
Oh, were you finished with your thought?
Yeah, I was just going to say, so you need to think about things before you do them. Check them out with somebody that understands the law.
Excellent advice. I know several people that have tried to just do all this on their own, and besides being more of a headache than it needs to be, it may not do what you want it to do.
Exactly. And you may be doing the exact opposite of what you want.
Right. I did want to ask, too, would life insurance for the individual with a disability count as an asset for them?
If the life insurance has cash value,
okay,
the cash value would count as an asset. If it's term life insurance, it would not count because that does not have any cash value. You're talking about if the person owns the policy, not is a beneficiary of the policy.
Right. Yeah. If it's for that individual.
If the individual is the beneficiary, that's not something that you want to do.
Right.
If the person owns the policy, and I'm not sure why he or she would, but if that's the case, and it's a term policy that does not have any cash value, that's not a accountable resource.
Okay. Kara from Illinois asks, do you work with families in other states?
No. Because this is the practice of law, doing wills and trusts, only someone who's admitted to practice in a particular state can draft wills and trusts for someone who lives in that state. And I'm admitted in Ohio. I am admitted in Kentucky, but I haven't practiced in Kentucky for many, many years. I'm not admitted in any other state, so I can't do this kind of work in any other state.
Mm-hmm. It's not a simple thing to go through to plan. It's not. Some people are finding it to be cost prohibitive, is what I'm trying to say. Can you give people maybe a ballpark estimate of what they can expect to pay for drawing up these documents? And I know it varies widely from state to state and attorney to attorney, but I think some people think it's out of their reach. I did.
I try to take into consideration what my client can afford in setting a fee, especially in this area. So if someone who lives in Ohio wants to contact me and discuss their situation, my fee might be, will likely be different,
mm-hmm,
than other clients.
Okay, so just check with the attorney and use your
check
tax refund and
yeah,
and get it done.
Yes.
That's what we did. Well, it is 11 o'clock. I told you the time would fly.
Yes, it did.
It's just been packed with information. I hope we've helped some folks. I've left the slide up with your contact information.
Okay.
So if people have questions, they can email you.
That would be fine.
You also have a website with lots of answers.
I would be happy to.
Okay, great. I want to thank you for coming on the program and for helping us try to sort through these things. It can be complicated, but you make it very understandable.
Thank you, and I appreciate your asking me to do this.
Well, maybe we should come on and do it again.
Please?
Maybe we should come on and do it again soon, because I'm sure that we barely touched the surface.
Well, yeah. We can talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Okay.
Okay, I appreciate it so much. I want to tell our listeners, too, that our next webinar will be January 19th, when we will have Dr. Jerry Cartsonell. We will get his information posted to the website soon, so you'll know the topic and everything. But Dr. Jerry is very well known in the autism community, so I'm sure it's going to be a very interesting topic. If you want a transcript of tonight's event, join our Spectrum Gold Club. It's just $1 to join, and you'll receive a copy of this webinar audio and transcript. Plus, you'll have access to all of our previous webinars. That's over 40 topics, including Autism 101, the basics, sensory integration therapy, effective IEP strategies, and much more. Also, tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. Again, that number is 877-211-0212. And I bid you all a fond farewell and a nice night. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.